He was a famous trumpet man from our Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was a top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with a draft. He's in the army now, I'm blowing reveille. He's a boogie boogie bugle boy of Company B. They made him blow a bugle for his Uncle Sam. It really brought him down because he couldn't jam. The captain seemed to understand. Because the next day the cap went out and drafted a band. And now the company jumps when he plays reveille. He's a boogie boogie bugle boy of Company B. A toot, a toot, a toot, till he had a toot. He blows it into the bar. In boogie rhythm, he can't blow a note unless a bass and guitar are playing with him. He makes the company jump when he plays reveille. He's a boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. He was the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. And when he plays boogie woogie bugle, he was busy as a buzz bee. And when he plays, he makes the company jump a to the bar. He's a boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. Do 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 riada do riada do 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 buzz it a to the bar. He can't blow a note. Every night and wakes them up the same way in the early bright. They clap their hands and stamp their feet because they know how he plays when someone gives him a beat. He really breaks it up when he plays reveille. He's a boogie boogie bugle boy of Company B.
Although I didn't know that particular track, I mean, I was probably a teenager when I first saw the Andrews Sisters, and I may even have heard Bette Midler's version of it first. And they worked really hard, and they came from Minnesota, which is, I think, where Bob Dylan came from as well. And they were good old girls, and they wore these uniforms, and they had this routine. They're very popular with soldiers, and they came from that wartime era that people say it was so terrible during the war, but I don't know, a lot of people seem to really have enjoyed it. I'm being very frivolous there, but from the music seems to have thrived quite a lot. You know, very close harmonies, quite a lot of what I call aptitude. You get ineptitude, you know, I don't know if you get aptitude. You can't be ept. That's what I like, you know. I said there was something sexy about those wartime clothes, you know. And someone said, "What, the tight skirts?" I said, "No, the clumpy shoes and the gas masks." You know, I'm a sucker for a woman who wears them. You know, and my mum was in the army. You know, she would have been in the navy unless we bought her out. But I can remember my mum saying, "You're in the army now. You're not behind a plough. You'll never get rich by digging a ditch. You're in the army now." I think that is an American bugle call. It's not a British one. And my dad and both my granddads, everybody in the army. So I was brought up in barracks. One brother born in Aldershot, another one born in Penang in Malaya. And I was born in Hertfordshire, only because that's, I think, where everyone happened to be. Well, in fact, we weren't all there. I think my dad was probably in Germany or something like that. Anyway, it was an army upbringing, 11 different schools for me and plenty of beatings. It was okay. So soldiers were my babysitters, and I lived in garrisons. I lived in Neesoon Garrison, and I went to school at Gilman Barracks, and I lived at Keogh Barracks, Ashvale, and I lived at in Kohima Place in Cyprus, and all these different places that were barrackses, or TA centres, where occasionally my dad would have to, as a regular soldier, would have to train the TA. And it was just all the army. So naturally, when the Beatles come along, I thought, right, I'm doing that then. I'm not doing that soldiery stuff. All the beatings and haircuts. And that was just my mum. People were more regimented. I mean, three quarters of the nation had been in the army. So if you wouldn't have this situation like you've got with badly behaved boys now. For a start, anyone was allowed to hit you, policemen and anyone else. And if you cheeked someone of your father's age, you weren't dealing with some sort of flabby guy who works in an office and used a mobile phone and sat around watching telly and munching pizzas. You were dealing with a bunch of very fit, lean guys who'd all been in the army, all knew unarmed combat, and could all run pretty fast if you did something. And then they spent their time gardening, walking or cycling. I mean, because no one had a car, or hardly anyone had a car. And so if you cheat someone, they were perfectly entitled to come after you and give you what they fondly called a clip round the ear, or sometimes a punch in the side of the head. And if you told your dad that that is what had happened, the first thing your dad would say was not, "I will get him," but, "Why did he hit you?" And you'll say, "Because I was throwing stones at his garage." And then your dad would hit you too. And that's what happened. So you get a whole nation of people who are brain injured and they all take drugs and now look what's happened. So that's so much for discipline. Kate Bush with Army Dreamers. It was a bit of a good period for her, that. I mean, she was just really starting to mature. I mean, there's bits of the track I don't really like. It's sung in her fayest voice, basically saying, isn't it sad, these young men, they're only teenagers and off they are, Northern Ireland, and now they think they're going to be soldiers, now they're shot. She comes from quite a middle-class family. When I came to Colchester, I was amazed, having grown up in barracks, about civilians prejudiced against these people called squaddies. In all my time growing up in barracks, I had never heard of a soldier being referred to as a squaddie. It was a new term. It's not a very nice word. Half the people who come from Colchester are actually the sons of soldiers themselves, or the grandsons of soldiers, or they've actually been in the army. And I remember this parade came through one year, about 1973, and I was standing outside the head gate idly watching this parade of different soldiers. And there were a bunch of the older reprobates from the ground, beards, you know, joint hanging out in their mouth and a pint of beer in their hand. And this woman, this rather smart-looking woman, shouted at one of these old sort of lags, just these hippie guys. She said, "You want to get your hair cut and do some time in the army?" And this guy said, "I did 9 years, me, pet, was with the Durham Light Infantry, and I fought in Northern Ireland, and I was in Cyprus and all." You know, like that. And then with that, he raised his pint and took a puff on his joint and gave her toes up, you know. Actually, I suppose Kate Bush's track was made round about the time of the Falklands, or just before, possibly. I didn't look at the date, but it was that sort of time. Definitely early Thatcher period. Yeah, it would have been about sometime between 80 and 82, I would imagine. And some good effects on there. You can hear the drill, the soldiers marching, and the click of guns. That's quite sensitively done. And she's singing this song. I don't know why I like it. It just captures my... In a way, I don't like it, but in other ways, it's captured my imagination. And that's what it reminds me of, that period round about the Falklands, when no one quite believed that the country was going to war. And on the... pretty much on the eve of me going 25 years later for a Falklands trip. That was the last war that had direct ancestry in Napoleonic times, where we sent a navy. We don't have a navy to send now. We still had 90 or 100 ships. We don't have that many ships now. The government got their way. And John Knott was just on the verge of scrapping the navy anyway. And he didn't. And soldiers lost their lives, and it was gory, and they came back, and there are still veterans from that, people damaged by it, people whose reputations were made by it. Well, they requisitioned a lot of merchant navy stuff, and they requisitioned the SS Canberra. That was for a troop ship. And they requisitioned the Atlantic Conveyor, which, of course, was sunk. So some of these civilian ships were sunk. Because you couldn't have a war like that. Not only you wouldn't hold a war like that now, not 25 years later. So it was a kind of, I mean, if it's not too cynical to say so, it's a kind of everything must go war. They just got every bit of tin that would float, and threw it at the war effort. And it took something like 3 weeks to get there. And although some of the vessels are really steaming there, they had to slow down because the supply vessels couldn't keep up. I think the mood in the country was one of jingoism, and it swept the country up. But I think where the left was wrong, really wrong, I mean, there's still a lingering misconception that Thatcher kind of held this war to boost her reputation because it got her back in. That's wrong on, I think, two counts now, he said with the wisdom of hindsight. One, I think she would have got back in anyway. She just would have got back in. And two, no leader takes a country to war deliberately. I mean, the Navy kind of led it, so far as I can understand. But no, you can't just start a war that easily. There's all sorts of... Before you do it, you've got to have a diplomat who goes to the UN and makes representations. It's not that easy to just go and start a war if you're living in, you know... in Europe, and it reflects very badly, and it's terrible for the economy, and it spends a lot of money. So it's not a cheap way of getting votes, and it's singularly stupid to think so. I remember Lowell of the Cleaners from Venus went to see his mum because she was in Derby, and he was on a coach, and she had emphysema. She was in the early stages of it, and he went to visit her. And he had to go on a coach because no one had any money. You know, we were working as cleaners, and he went up there. And he came back a bit crestfallen, and I said, "You know, what's happened?" He said, "I was on the coach coming back, and they suddenly turned the radio on. And the news came over really loud that our boys had shot down another Argentinian superintendent, or whatever it was. And the whole coach erupted in wild applause. And Lowell shouted at the top of his voice, "Bullshit!" And the guy next to him grabbed him by the lapel, pushed his face right up to him and said, "What did you mean?" Like that, you know. So that's the kind of the heat of emotion that was going on. And I think the overall, there was a vast majority who thought the war was a great idea and loved seeing our chaps, you know, giving a, you know, we're a very bellicose nation in a lot of ways. It doesn't take much. People singing songs in pubs and the delirious welcome, the troops and the send off they got. And you've got all the teachers and the sort of beardies and the sort of people running around wringing their hands saying, oh dear, this is dreadful. Oh God, I'm going to live in France.
He came from a northern town, got sick of hanging round, met with some simple girl, seemed to brighten up his world. Housekeeper, friend and nurse, they got married, he got worse. Took to a soldier's life, never saw his wife. Said things would not be the same without you. I will change all those things that I do, and I'll miss you and the cold English rain. Things will change when the ships sail home again. She seemed so far away, he wrote three times a day. Desert, nothing doing, camouflage and tea can brewing. Got no order to move out, rumours rife, life in doubt. Sometimes felt like screaming out, mouth too dry to shout. Said things would not be the same without you. I will change all those things that I do.
That is just called Gulf War Song. And it's seen from the point of view of a soldier who suddenly realises what his life is worth. He's been a bit of a waster and he's joined the army and he's given his faithful missus a bit of a bad time. Then he, you know, I can't really be anti-soldiers because, you know, it's a popularly held misconception that soldiers all like this stuff and that you won't find anyone more anti-war than a soldier. That's it, you know. Soldiers don't like war. There was like this northern wag, I know, Dave, who was just saying, well, you know, do you think our lads are going to have to fight? And I think this might have been Kosovo. And he said, well, so someone's going to have to go into the barracks and tap one of them on the shoulder gently and say, can we have you off your sunbeds for a minute, lads? We've got a war to fight. But I remember I was getting bored and I always liked the vocal sound different, so I put the headphones on the ground and throw it in. It was a room next to the bog, so I'd throw the headphones into the bog, mic them up, and then put a mic and feed it back through the desk to see what it sounded like, and that's why you've got that slightly weird dismembered voice. But it's meant to be, you know, the guy on the phone on some kind of faulty landline back to his missus saying, look, I really miss you. When I get home, it'll be really great.
When the sun is shining bright, dispelling all the dews of night with Sam Brown, belt and button stripe, behold the Sergeant Major. Batman makes my army bed, and soon my boots are luster shed. He turns me out from foot to head, a dapper Sergeant Major. Then woe to them that meet my eye. They never do, they turn and fly. When I'm here on parade in the square, how the folk passing by turn and stare. For they say this beats the best, the way he handles the men is grand. When I shout, birds fly out, daisies fade. I've a way that must be obeyed. It's the old say I fight while recruits die of fright when the sergeant major's on parade. Eyes as keen as sparrow hawk, or like a lobster on a stalk. No nudge or wink or smile or talk escapes the sergeant major. Oh, I've got a fearful name, and folks say it's a crying shame. They'd like to kill or haul for fame that fiend, the Sergeant Major. But that's the proper army style. And now and then they see me smile. When I'm here on parade in the square, how the folk passing by turn and stare. I've a way that must be obeyed. It's the old say I fight when recruits die of fright when the sergeant major's on parade.
Pick him up there. What the, where the, who? Pick him up there. Fatigue for you. Left, left, left. Is that the way we won Waterloo? Come along there, jump to it, me lad. If you don't, you'll hear me call a spade. Left, left, party, run!
The sergeant major's on parade.
Peter Dawson, the sergeant major's on parade, was many things, apart from a folk devil and a figure of dread. He was also someone to be respected, and he was kind of like your mum. He was the nearest thing you had to your mum. And, you know, for young chaps away from home, you got good sergeants as well as bad. But he became a mythical creature, the British sergeant major with his moustache and his shouting and his sarcasm. Because most of the British sergeant majors, they're not all devoid of wit. They've usually got a bit of sus, and it's very cruel. And I know my dad had it, but, I mean, his favourite character was the Windsor Davis guy in Windsor Davis character, Sergeant Major Williams, was it? Sergeant Major Williams.
Shoulders back, boy. Show him off. Find better shoulders you got there.
You know, and he'd just get in. He picked up this book by Mr. Lardy-Dar Gunner Graham once and said,
what's this, a book?
It's a book, Sergeant Major.
Useless by James Joyce. Never have I seen such rampant puffery. Oh yeah, this year is the jungle and you lot is going in it.
Yeah.
street sounds to the soldier's tread, and out we troop to see. A single redcoat turns his head. He turns and looks at me. My man, from sky to sky so far, we never crossed before. Such leagues apart the world's ends are. We like to meet no more. What thoughts at heart have you and I? We cannot stop to tell. But dead or living, drunk or dry, soldier, I wish you well. Oliver's Army by Elvis Costello, which I went out and bought. Oddly enough, I bought it for the B-side, which was a version of him singing My Funny Valentine, which is wonderful. Elvis Costello's songs, he's known as being this great words man. Really brilliant, you know. And it's true, he's good at words. He strings words together and they sing beautifully. But they don't always, when you break them down, make any sense. You know, if there's a lucidity there, it's a cracked lucidity. Oliver's Army, who is Oliver's Army?
Naked, a sin, an army towel covering my belly. Some of us weep, some of us howl, knees turn to jelly. But next, I was just a child, 100 like me. I followed a naked body followed me. Next. I was just a child when my innocence was lost in a mobile army hoon house, a gift of the army, free of cost. Next, next, next. Me, I really would have liked a little bit of tenderness, maybe a word, maybe a smile, maybe some happiness, but next. Oh, it was not so tragic and heaven did not fall. But how much at the time I hated being there at all. Next, next. I still recall the brothel trucks, the flying flags. The queer lieutenant slapped our asses thinking we were fake. Next, next. A voice that thinks of whiskey, corpses and of mud. The voice of nations, the thick voice of blood. Next, next. Since then each woman I have taken into bed, they seem to lie on my arms and they whisper in my head.
The reason I like the Alex Harvey one is, again, it's Jacques Brel who's written this. I've got every reason to suppose the translation's as good as it can be. I think it's Mort Shuman who did that translation. And it's particularly graphic, brutal lyrics by Jacques Brel, who the Belgian, who the French appropriated and who smoked himself to death. And it's sung amazingly well by Alex Harvey's hoarse, gutter Glaswegian voice. And it just completely works. And it's also, it's a continental idea of being a conscript, which is a little different. I mean, it's a little different to the English conscript. We're very familiar with, oh, the Sergeant Major's horrible name, get me up and all the insults, am I standing on your hair, lad? But this is the French conscript or the Belgian conscript talking about his conscription. And it's a little bit bleaker. And, you know, the French... There's this idea that, well, you know, the cheese-eating surrender monkeys gag, that the French are somehow cows, that they didn't quite pull their weight in the Second World War. The reason they didn't quite pull their weight in the Second World War is because they'd lost many of their guys in the First World War. That was it. They'd had entire villages wiped out. The French lost so many people that the ones who were left were kind of being asked by their missuses and everyone who loved them, look, maybe not rush into it quite so much this time. Maybe just, yeah, okay, fight, be in the Maquis or something, but please don't. The French had a rough time. And I don't think they're cowards any more than anyone else. Mohammed's fillings buckle and occlusal in gaping mouth when he throws back his head confirm the diligence of Baghdad dentists, if not the fact his little daughter's dead. This picture of the grocer is unusual, his howling anguish, shock and disbelief, the intimacy wedded to intrusion. A war allows us windows on such grief. In eastern England now the spring advances. A sharp east wind still nibbles at the days. In Colchester, the soldiers' pubs stay empty, as field by field the farmland turns to bays. The rooks are building higher, which enhances the chance that summer comes up with the goods. The sergeant's wives must exercise the dogs now. They hear the transport planes above the woods. A gung-ho newsman on the television, in self-important, bullying, semi-dark, with barely bridled relish, talks of tactics astride a giant model of Iraq. A line of virtual tanks take up position and flash up gold explosions on attack. If science can put missiles through a cat flap, it won't bring poor Mohammed's daughter back. In Babylon, they've cluster bombs, not towers. In Nineveh, not Quinquereem, but Bradley, where hope dissolves in nausea and migraine, the ancient world is doing rather badly. The children of the modern world spend hours with drips in arms and bandages on heads, and surgical are strikes, which does seem clearer, observing tiny patients on their beds. You bet your melted boots we're coming, mister. A war is best held fresh, or it'll spoil. You gotta go in hard to burst a blister, especially if that blister's full of oil. Poor Mohammed held his daughter, kissed her, brushed the blood and dust from matted hair, noting that her body seemed much lighter, never seeing the camera clicking near. Thank you. Pink Floyd were motoring at this time. They made this great album, an album, you know, again, damned by its ubiquity, but it was there, and it was there at the charts in so long because it was good. So Roger Waters had a bee in his bonnet about the soldiery in much the same way as I do, or maybe more so. And some of the lyrics in this are pretty good. General sat and the lions of the map moved from side to side. He also seems to ally the spending of money and the pointlessness of war on poverty. So there's, at the same time as holding a big epic war, you've got, for want of the price of tea and a slice, the old man died. And in a way, it's a side swipe too, but he has thought about it. You know, it's really lasted. Nearly every track on the album is a goodie, but this is the one. It can be. It's very, very powerful. If you sit and listen to it at the end of a tiring day in a softly lit room, and just after a drink or something, you just, it's a great track. I'm amazed. I don't hear it for years at a time, and then I put it on to check it out. I think, bloody hell, that's good.
Yeah.
was Legs Larry Smith, the writer of that, which I didn't know. I know the track so well. And just one of the funniest guys ever, I think, Mel Brooks. He was a stand-up comedian, and I believe he was a musician too. The fact that this is a sign of a hugely civilised society, that maybe not even 30 years after the Holocaust, it is able to laugh at the whole thing, to lampoon it, and for one of the race that was most persecuted by it, that suffered the brunt of the horror, is able to go and make this huge statement, this joke about it. That is a sign of a civilised society that has allowed that. You know, and I'm not sure that it could happen now. It happened in the late 60s, early 70s. I think it was 1969, the producers, and it must have been getting worked on before that, I think. That they could do that. The Bonzo Dogs, I grew up in a school, you know, where everyone just drew swastikas on their exercise books. You know, you just drew swastikas everywhere. And if you had drew a plane, you know, on your exercise book, you know, you drew a swastika on it. You drew a swastika on your webbing bag that you took your school books to school in. Well, I didn't go to a very posh school, so I got a cheap webbing bag and you drew a swastika on it. People said, oh, you shouldn't really do that, because your mum would say, oh, you know, do you know what that means? But it didn't really. Everyone just drew swastikas everywhere and went around making jokes about the Germans. And if anyone shouted at someone, the first thing you did was stuck your finger under your nose as an imaginary moustache and went round goose-stepping, you know, with your hand up in the air. And you couldn't do that now. But I think that kind of stuff is a safety valve. And I think the whole of that track, it shows you, yes, we remember the war. We do remember the war, and we know it was horrible. It was so horrible, we've made this great funny movie about it. The whole of the producers is about anti-heroes. You've got a Jewish accountant who's not doing very well, really. And then you've got Zero Mostel playing this terrible impresario. And then the biggest anti-hero of all is the poor German soldier who's the misguided soldier with his pigeons, who loves his pigeons, and he wears his trench coat and he's got his not Pickelhauber, the German helmet. And he's written this musical called Springtime for Hitler. Yeah, he's probably probably a good soldier. I mean, he's a nutter, yes, but there's something very lovable about them all. It's great. And then they choose a flower child to play Hitler. It was unimpeachable. Anyone trying to take Mel Brooks to task for that. He did a very clever thing there, you know. When the British and everybody went into Baghdad, but the Germans didn't, someone said, send him a postcard saying, you know, shame you're not here, it's not the same without you, you know. When I was doing Ted Jarvis, I used to break off for a lecture about a regiment, because I said my dad was in the... What regiment was he in? I said, the King's Own Surrealists. And people go, oh, yes, he flew tanks. You know, and they were responsible for smuggling a small herd of llamas into the through a tunnel of 17 metres, and they managed to get into the German cooks, the mess tent, so that the German cook sergeants were confused, and then the men wouldn't get their mood, and wouldn't get their food, and the King's Own Surrealists did vital war work, and their... Misses, though, who were all working in a munitions factory, you got a thing called fuzzy jaw, which made your jaw come up, you know, and they were up the duff. So, you know, they all went off and they got VD as well. So they didn't come home. Because what's the point? You've got VD, you've come home to a missus who's up the spout, very resentful, and looks like Desperate Dan. And they had this song called Keep Your Gherkin Gleaming, Charlie Boy, you know, which is, it's got all the wartime expressions in. I'd do this live, you know. It's that sort of thing my granddad used to sing. We'd have that high-pitched whistle. And so I made up this composite song, and I got a whole audience to sing along, and I kidded them on it was a wartime song. But only when it got to the chorus, they realised, no, they wouldn't write a song like that because it's quite rude. Are you a Charlie boy who's the mademoiselle who's polishing up your gherkin while I'm gone? Keep your hand on your half a crown and wash your wonka clean, and don't go near the grocer's garden, you don't know where she's been. Charlie boy, the butler never saw her, a whatchamacallit in the bedroom drawer. It's what your whoopsie daisy's for, it's nothing to do with the man next door, so keep your gherkin gleaming, Charlie boy. Keep
Keep your gherkin gleaming, Charlie boy. Keep your gherkin gleaming, Charlie boy. While the trench is steaming, what's the use of dreaming? Keep your gherkin gleaming, Charlie boy. Keep your gherkin gleaming, Charlie boy. Keep your gherkin gleaming, Charlie boy. While the trench is steaming, what's the use of dreaming? Keep your gherkin gleaming, Charlie boy. And it goes on like that, you know, and we've got them all joining in, that whole perfect rank of perfectly respectable middle-class people, and they're going, eh? What? Keep your gherkin gleaming? What? Oh, yes, well, you know, this well-known First World War song, but I've just put in all the clichés, you know. Oh, yeah, watch him a-calling it in the bedroom door, have a banana.